Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will talk about China's long-term growth prospects in light of its own demographics. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter Zhonghua Mundus. The link to subscribe is in the show notes. This feature is also part of Bruegel Project China Horizon, funded by the EU under the Horizon program. And I'm happy to have both Alicia Garcia Herrero, who is leading the China Horizon project and co-authored a paper on this topic, and Max Zenglein, who is the chief economist at Merricks, and his research focuses on China's macroeconomic development, international trade, and industrial policy. Alicia, welcome back to The Sound of Economics, and Max, welcome for your first time to our show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Indeed, very good to have Max with us.
Back to the topic. China's astounding growth for the last few decades have been slowing down for the last decade. According to a baseline analysis included in your paper, Alicia, for China's medium-term growth, we should expect it to fall all the way to 2.4% by 2035, the year in which President Xi's China's dream would supposedly have to be accomplished. In other words, by 2035, China's GDP will be similar to the one of the United States, perhaps even slightly bigger. This also means that the Chinese economy will not become much larger than that of the United States in the foreseeable future, which has important geopolitical implications, including the very likely continuation of the current systemic rivalry. Which are the factors pushing down the growth, Alicia?
Thank you, Giuseppe. The problem for me is that there are too many factors. I'm going to be brief, and I'm sure Max can add to the list. So if one just looks at any growth account determining potential growth in any country in the world, you basically have the two factors of production, labor and capital, the actual input, for example, the supply of labor or the amount of investment, and then the return on labor and the return on capital. And then we have the so-called black box, which determines the residual or, you know, what really helps determine potential growth that we cannot easily measure. And I would argue that's where innovation should be basically imputed. By one, I think what we realize is that labor will not grow in China. We have a paper on that showing that actually this factor is not as bad as others, so which is interesting because we all think it's only about aging, which is determining the slowdown in the Chinese economy. And we find estimates that this is not so much the case before 2035, thereafter, though. And so the main issue is that the return on capital is very low, that labor productivity is decelerating, and that China cannot put too much more capital into the economy because already investment to GDP is so humongously large. So that's the main thing. Of course, you know, the expectation is that China will innovate so much, or is innovating so much, I would say, that they can overcome all of these challenges by just merely innovating, i.e. increasing total factor productivity. And what we argue is that maybe, but we don't see it in the data yet. Total factor productivity in China has actually come down in the last decade. So that's all from my side to start.
Max, which are your additions to what Alicia just said, or complementary analysis to what we heard?
But just maybe adding on to some of the things that Alicia said in terms of the investment-driven growth. So this is still remarkably high, and we're seeing that in the current adjustments that it's also a sign of a concern by the Chinese leadership. We see it in the concerns they have about debt. We have, you know, massive growth of the past that has been attributed to infrastructure, but also the real estate sector as China has been urbanizing. So these are also factors that are reaching its limitations and are requiring a shift in China's economic policies. And at the moment, I think at least there's attempts to cautiously, I would say, readjust investments. but it's not yet going into consumption-driven growth. So they're trying to, as Alicia pointed to, invest in manufacturing and innovation. So it's basically reallocation of investment that's going on, and we're not seeing a shift towards consumption-driven growth.
I see. You both mentioned aging, and even if it might not be such a negative factor for long-term growth as initially expected, its full impact very much depends on how labor productivity, which you mentioned, Alicia, may react to an aging population. The experience of Japan does not bode well for China. Could there be reasons to believe that China might be different than Japan in that regards, and in which way?
Well, I will start by saying that, just to clarify, so Japan's labor productivity has been falling since the bubble burst. Of course, the population has also fallen, but the point is that there's been a positive correlation. Both things have been falling. This is notwithstanding the fact that Japan has the largest share of robots per capita in the world. So if it's all about robotization and reducing the impact of the fall in the labor supply, Japan shows that it is not so easy. But of course, China might be different. Perhaps the sheer amount of innovation in many, many areas, including industrial digitalization, you name it, might change this correlation, positive correlation between the labor supply and labor productivity. But, you know, I'm nobody to judge, because it's very hard to know. But I think Japan is a cautionary tale for China, meaning it's not so easy to mitigate the impact of the falling population by just increasing labor productivity.
Max?
Yeah, I think what we will see with the aging population is that the pressure in terms of fine-tuning economic policy is just going to increase. And that is that at the moment, a lot of the economic policy is especially now since the confrontation with the US is getting more severe, is focused on closing tech gap, on boosting China's technological capabilities. But they have been kicking the can down the road when it comes to building a social safety net, reforming the pension system, so on. As the population gets older, these issues are going to get more pressing. And also, you're dealing with a middle class that's going to be more demanding. So I think this is going to be, you know, an added concern that they're quite aware of, but I think have not been addressing properly at the moment.
But basically, what we are saying here is that there is going to be quite an interesting and crucial equation between productivity gains, innovation, and closing the gap with the aging population on the same time. And this is all going to be put in a mix, if we can say. We are not going to go very much in depth into the innovation side. Also, we are going to dedicate another episode to go really into this. But we cannot escape that element from what we are saying. I mean, Alicia, you say that there might not be, or there could not be, the same trajectory when it comes to innovation when we take the example of Japan and when we take the example of China. And currently, innovation has really been a mantra with state discourse and propaganda and so forth. So which initial elements or conclusions one should draw from this, and which are the elements at least to watch on that then we can get more in-depth enlightenment on?
So what we find is that while China is doing its utmost, as you said, both politically in terms of prioritizing innovation and building a society that is ready to adopt innovation, which is very important, there's also some difficulties in doing so because there are bottlenecks to, no matter how many financial efforts China may be putting, and we have a lot of data in an incoming publication on, you know, R&D being already higher than Europe in terms of GDP, or the number of scientific publications already higher than the US, even at the top 1%. But ultimately, the impact of all of this seems to be constrained. Of course, if you look at value added in exports, China is doing very well. But when you look at, again, productivity, it's not clearly there. And we find three main bottlenecks to explain this reality. The first one is the role of the state in the economy. Estimates out there point to 2/3 of innovation, so R&D, being state-owned. And, you know, with what that means in terms of allocation of resources, etc. The second is more recent, but very relevant, which is the US containment, technological containment on China, which, again, might not explain the lack of increase in total factor productivity in the last decade, but it might explain why the future total factor productivity might not be increasing as, you know, in light of all of the efforts China has done. And third, and very importantly, because I started with this idea that the party has pushed the society to be ready for innovation, the society is starting to also see that, you know, the ultra-competitive environment that China society is going through might not be pleasant for everybody. There's a lot of evidence of, you know, number of hours of gaming by the youth in Asia. China is the highest, more than South Korea. Then you have, of course, very high youth unemployment at the moment, nearly 20%. You know, it seems like there's this sense of what is it all for? And I think that's very important because we are assuming this linear trend that, you know, the whole society will go along, but we don't know that yet. So these are the three issues. The first being the most obvious for the past. The second are more future or, you know, present to the future, containment and the societal changes that we're seeing in China already today.
Max?
Yeah, I'd like to add on a few points on the last point Alicia made, because I think it's very important. And I think in the previous decades, China's economic development has pretty much been in sync with increasing the well-being of the overall society. And that is getting much more complex. So now you have the ambition to move into or becoming more innovative, and it's a much more complex story than it was in the past, from getting relatively poor people from the rural areas into the urban centers and into the factories, where also major productivity gains were to be made. Now you have a situation where whole trajectory is no longer so much in sync, and we already see the pressure building. I mean, China will have, again, roughly 12 million university graduates that are coming into the labor market. Not all of them are engineers and scientists, even though the share of you know, these type of degrees are relatively high, but still it creates some pressure. And we are seeing that the economy at the moment, even though companies are responding and investing heavily in tech and innovation, it's not creating the jobs that they need. We have youth unemployment that's approaching 20%. So this is creating pressure, and we'll also focus on some realignment. Otherwise, people are going to get unhappy in this story.
And coming to a view on our side of the world, and what does this mean for Europe? How important would China's structural deceleration be for the EU as such? Which are the potential consequences, Alicia?
This is a hard question. You know, one would be tempted to say, well, if China decelerates, so be it, because China was such a threat. But let's face it, China has been enormously important for the global economy, 25 to a third, depending on the year, percent of, you know, contribution to global growth. It doesn't necessarily mean that because China doesn't grow, our competition is going to be reduced. On the contrary, one could argue that because China is having an even harder time to make it, to become that global hegemon, China could become more hostile or, you know, more aggressive. We don't really know. So, you know, I'm just not reading this as China is becoming a normal country. China can't defy gravity, which is the title of our paper. So be it. Nobody could. So that's fine. South Korea couldn't. Japan couldn't. But China is a different animal because it has this vision, intention to change the global order. So the fewer the resources to do so doesn't necessarily mean the better, doesn't it? It's just harder. And in that regard, perhaps it could become more abrupt, if I may say so. So I wouldn't read into what it means for Europe very positively. I would only say that what becomes harder for China might become harder for the world as well.
Max, do you agree with that?
Yes, I agree largely, but I also think just adding a different element to that is that, you know, I think it's quite important for us in Europe to adjust our expectations when it comes to China. And I think a slower growing China also means different things for China itself. I think that's a bigger headache than potentially for at least the economic development that Europe might have with China. But it's, I think, important to remind ourselves of the limitations that also China has in terms of its growth. and are just also business expectations, export expectations when it comes to this, and just move away from this belief that China's development is going to be linear and smooth. Clearly, China is now facing, you know, a lot of external and internal threats to its growth, and that's just going to make it more complex during a phase of their economic development that is probably the most trickiest. So I think this is something that we need to get used to having more disruptions. And given the Chinese economic system or political system, that also bears the risk also of further tensions growing. So we're looking, I think, into quite a complex future with China.
Just to follow up on this, because it seems that there is one aspect in all that, especially in these consequences for the rest of the world, the EU and so forth, which needs to be dispelled. We've been hearing more and more, both from EU officials, we've been hearing from the Biden administration more recently, this wall stressing out the fact that while there is a competition, there is rivalry on many fronts, there is not overall, at least it has not been stated, idea that the rest of the world wants to stop China's growth. I mean, that has been a kind of explicit mention by several officials. What do we make out of it? You know, because of course, then there is the reality of the geopolitical competition, there is the security threat, there are so many elements in this complex situation. But what shall we make out of this statement? Is it like consistent with what Alicia was just saying about the fact that, after all, we not necessarily want a China economy which is going to shrink completely or collapse, and that in the end of the day we are still speaking about an economy which is still very much integrated with the rest of the global economy, despite the bifurcation process is being in action at the moment? How do we navigate this, basically? Max, maybe I look at you first.
Well, I think nobody wants to or should wish for a collapse of the Chinese economy. And if maybe to derive something positively is that also China's view on the has been driven by changing external dimensions and focused on the rivalry with the United States and other parts of the world. And maybe these internal factors that also Alicia pointed out in her paper that will create pressure and realign or force an economic policy to readjust and, you know, prioritizing also the well-being of the society, more forceful measures trying to deal with inequality, not only within the society, but also across regions within China, and trying to shift their emphasis and priorities. And I'm trying to give a bit of a more optimistic outlook here in terms of what it deals with, having a, you know, slower growing China. So that would, I think, be a positive way that also would enable us to stay as integrated as possible, given, you know, the new realities with China. Whilst in a more negative way would be that China really doubles down on national strategic goals and sets these as the utmost priority while accepting domestic troubles and using a more repressive economic or political system to turn down those voices. So I think these are the things that we need to be looking out for and will shape how also Europe and others will deal with China.
Thank you. And Alicia, some last words from you.
Yes, I fully agree with Max. I think, you know, this is the whole point, is that nobody should be happy with China, Chinese economy decelerating. If anything, we should worry if this deceleration is too rapid. What does that mean for engagement versus containment versus de-risking? I think anything we do, we have to be very, very cautious, no doubt about it. But the main point here is that China's structural deceleration hardly depends on us. This is to be noticed that U.S. containment has, I would say, just started. The main action happened in October last year. So we cannot explain China's structural deceleration because of the U.S. This is important. And we hear this a lot in China in particular. So let's look at it to hope that it won't be too fast and to understand that the factors are internal to China and that we need to understand those factors the best we can to take action on our side as well.
Thank you, Alicia. We could discuss for much longer, but unfortunately, this is all the time we have for this episode. As mentioned, Alicia is working on a paper on this topic, and it will be published soon, so stay tuned for that. I would like to remind our listeners as well that, as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Alicia, Max, thank you for joining this conversation. And thanks a lot to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.